So today I'll talk about some work we've done on looking for evidence of adaptation in Drosophila in humans. Before I tell you about the data, the logic behind it, I just want to acknowledge people who did the work. So it was all, both pieces are, is a collaboration with Guy Sella, who is here, and who's going to be here next week. I'm not going to be here next week, so I'm sure he'll be very happy to answer questions if I'm not here about this work. So he is the senior author, kind of co-supervised all of this work with me. Drosophila work, much of the kind of conceptual and computational heavy lifting was done by Mike McPherson, who was a graduate student in Mark Feldman's lab at Stanford. And I was working at 23andMe, and Gerald Davis, who's a graduate student in my lab. And James Kai, who's a postdoc in my lab right now, has done all of the computational work in humans. I just want to acknowledge the people. All right. So just going to motivate what I'm going to be talking about, I want to start from neutral theory. And so from one of the key kind of conceptual lesson that people have learned from neutral theory in analyzing DNA sequences, so doing comparative genomics. So this is a screenshot from UCSC browser that puts together sequences from different mammalian genomes, aligns them, and looks at this score of conservation, which is basically how many bases are conserved in a particular location in the genome after the alignment across a number of mammalian species, so mouse, rat, rabbit, dog, armadillo, elephant, opossum. So the blue line is the cumulative conservation score. When it's high, it means that the bases are conserved. When it's low, it's not. And so also the grayscale tells you how much conservation there is. Here are the genes. And you can see that the peaks of conservation tend to be where the genes are. Right, so the logic that people use in looking at this data is sort of fairly simple. When you see something like this, there's a lot of conservation, you say there's a lot of function there. And when you see a region like this, you say this region is devoid of function. And sort of in many ways, that's sort of the level of sophistication in this. Just the more conservation, the more function there is. So why would that be so? So in many ways, it's not a very natural conclusion. If you're a Darwinist, you may not think that that should be this way. But we have been inculcated by the neutral theory for so long that that it seems very natural. So what's the logic here? The logic here is the logic of a neutral theory that makes two key postulates about the process of molecular evolution. One of them is that adaptive evolution at the molecular level is so rare that pretty much all the time you can ignore it. So if you're interested in understanding the pattern of molecular change, adaptive evolution does happen, but it can be safely ignored. And because of that, the only reason for rate of evolution to vary across the genome is for constraint to vary. Some positions are constrained, some positions are not, and that's going to underline change in the rate of evolution, conditional on mutation rate being constant. So if you control for the variation in mutation rate, the only thing that's going to affect rates of evolution is constraint. So I'm going to sort of set up a simple kind of cartoon to explain this maybe a little bit more precisely. Imagine that we somehow went into the genome and were able to separate the sites into those that encode function and those that don't. Right, so some of the sites that are so silent sites, any nucleotide at that position is equivalently good for as far as selection is concerned, or does not carry any information, and there are coding sites that actually encode phenotypic information. So if we control for differences in mutation rates, so we did that properly, then we can assume that mutation is going to happen at the same rates at both of these positions, so the numbers of mutations are going to be the same. But what neutral theory says is that a very large proportion or substantial proportion of mutations at coding sites are going to be so deleterious that they're going to be removed immediately by selection. They're going to be, if you're a strict neutralist, then they're going to be removed so quickly that you never see them. You never see them either as polymorphism in the population or as divergence between species. they're removed right away. So they're kind of effectively lethals. So when that happened, once you remove the very deleterious mutations, everything that you have after that are strictly neutral ones, right? So deleterious ones are gone, the white ones are strictly neutral ones. And now all you have are truly neutral mutations, both at coding sites and silent sites. And because they're truly neutral as far as neutral theory is concerned, then their fate in populations are going to be the same. There's no difference between them, and so they will, with time, they will. Some of them will fix by, as neutral theory postulates, by genetic drift. And the because the probabilities are going to be the same, they're all neutral. The ratios of divergence sites for coding sites and silent sites simply going to be the same ratio that you see here. So once you remove deleterious mutations, that determines the ratio of changes at coding sites and silent sites. Right? So this ratio is the same. Now these neutral mutations also have a chance of being seen as polymorphisms within species, and again they have the same probability of being seen as polymorphisms at silent and coding sites because they're equivalently neutral. So if that's how you see the world, then it becomes sort of fairly straightforward to look for function. You simply look at places in the genome that have a lower rate of evolution than some neutral standard. So if you know some sites in your genome, for example, transposable elements that you know inserted and are dead on arrival, which is what people do in human genome now, in some of the studies. If you have that standard, then any region that evolves slower is evolving slower because of constraint. Right? Yeah?
I think this is actually very important because there's a typical misconception about the typical argument is that the underlying mutation rate itself, the probability of a base mutating, is not different in various regions or different categories of sites.
Yeah.
But what could be different, like illustrated by that bar on the left, where the hash is eliminated, is the mutation rate to neutral alleles in those regions. And sometimes you say that as kind of code word that encodes this whole idea that it's not necessarily, we're not saying mutation rate difference, but the proportion of sites that can mutate to neutral alleles may be different. Right? And
so neutral mutation rate.
The neutral mutation rate.
Yeah. Now, mutation rate can itself vary, which complicates this kind of analysis. But there are approaches to try to control for that. All right, so that's the idea, right? So behind this logic. Now, clearly something is missing here because mouse, rat, rabbit, dog, armadillo, and elephant, and opossum do not look identical to each other. So it's not that all of the evolution is just preserving the same functionality that existed in the ancestor of the species. Some of the differences between armadillo and dog are probably adaptive, and they must be encoded somewhere in the genome. So somewhere in the genome, there got to be changes that are not neutral, right? And the logic of where to look for these differences. So it comes from two seminal papers by Hudson, Kreitman, and Aguada, and also, but in this particular case, by McGonnell and Kreitman in 91. And the logic is that if this is what you predict from neutral theory, then if you're looking for changes that are adaptive, the underlying adaptive difference between species, that they're most likely to be observed in this class right here. And the reason for it is twofold. One, clearly if there's adaptive differences, they got to be happening in the functional sites, right? They're not going to be happening in sites that do not encode any information. So they got to be here, either here or here. But because these differences are adaptive, if they're strongly adaptive, then they have a high probability of fixation in a population, but they have relatively small probability of being observed as a polymorphism. They change in frequency so fast that you tend not to see them in a population. or at least the relative probability between probability of seeing them as a divergent site compared to polymorphic site is much greater for adaptive ones compared to neutral ones. Right? Does this make sense? Right. So then this sets up kind of a simple 2x2 test. Right? You're trying to see whether the number of differences at coding sites that are different between species is too high compared to what you would expect from the levels of polymorphism at coding and silent sites within species, so polymorphism, and the amount of divergence at silent sites. Right? So the extent to which it's too high tells you that there is positive selection. And so the 91 paper looked at ADH, and indeed there was evidence that this bar was too high, and actually quite a bit too high. I think there were some, you probably remember, so something like 7 amino acid differences, and you expect 2. So out of 7, 5 kind of appear to be adaptive, which is a 5/7. That's a big proportion of amino acid differences that appear to be adaptive in ADH between two species, Malagaster and Yacuba. Right. So that was sort of interesting, and people started doing this test with a few genes, and sometimes they would find the signal, sometimes they would not find the signal. And it kind of stayed that way until beginning of the 21st century, I suppose, the 2002, where two papers at once came out in Nature that did a sort of simple thing where they combined the data from a number of genes, and they looked at these McDonald-Kreitman table together, and they tried to estimate the sort of average proportion of amino acid differences in Drosophila that appeared to be adapted. And the shocking thing was that it was sort of like this on average. So between maybe 30% and 50% of differences at amino acid coding sites between Malagaster and I don't remember the species, but some of the Drosophila species appear to have been driven by positive selection. So. Not at all the way neutral theory would say. So adaptive evolution cannot be safely ignored. It's half of the divergence at functional sites, at least according to this test. And rate of evolution may not vary just with the selective constraints. Some sites might have a higher yellow part, larger yellow part. Some sites can have, some genes can have a smaller yellow part. So rate of evolution can also vary quite a bit in principle, although it's not clear whether it does or not, with the rate of adaptation. Right. So that's the moment when I switched from studying mutational biases to starting to look at adaptation. Complete disbelief, and then when so the first attempts to see what's wrong with the logic failed, we started doing something else. We started looking for other signatures, trying to see, well, if this is true, maybe we can see, we need to see some other pieces of evidence that would support this claim. Yeah?
Yes. Maybe you're going to discuss this, but it also might be relevant to some of the problems. Possible alternative explanations for this.
For what? For why that would be the case? Yeah, I will. Okay. So so the one simple possibility for this excess would be that the level of constraint varies through time. Right. So the logic here is kind of a steady state logic that everything, it's basically test of homogeneity. Everything stays the same. So if constrained, the level of constraint stays the same through evolution, then this should be true, right? But imagine that at right now the strength of purifying selection is greater than it was on average in the past. So then this bar would be too low. So all of these would be neutral. On average through evolution. The Y bar was here, but now it just so happened, let's say population size has become greater recently, purifying selection is stronger, and this bar went down. right? Because the whether a mutation is deleterious or not is not simply a function of whether it has deleterious effect on the phenotype, but whether it's sufficiently deleterious to be noticed by selection in the face of stochasticity induced by drift. So if the population size is very small, then something that, in fact, deleterious may not be noticed as a deleterious mutation. It may be seen as a polymorphism, and in principle may be seen as divergence. Yeah.
I have a history question. So, I mean, the left-hand side, if you look at this and what you said was classical neutralist, this is a very coarse picture, but at least sort of it's consistent. But then there was also exactly what you mentioned now, this discussion about the how much would be slightly deleterious mutation and so on. Also, like before the adaptation was discovered.
Yeah.
So at the point when you think about slightly deleterious mutation, then the left-hand side becomes sort of internally inconsistent, because then you can also are speeches going to go slowly down the drain, and how is this compensated, and so on. Was that an issue that
it was an issue, yeah.
Or, because the left-hand side as it stands by itself would be a possibility how it could be. But exactly when you put in these slightly deleterious ones, then is where the sort of the intrinsic question marks start.
Well, you can have a lot of slightly deleterious mutations that will be seen as polymorphisms, but when it comes to fixations, right? So when it comes to fixations, the number of slightly deleterious, slightly advantageous should balance each other out.
So exactly, and then you would see things under positive selection, and
you won't.
So this test is actually conservative with respect to slightly deleterious mutations, because slightly deleterious mutations do have selection acting against them, but weakly so, then they could rise to some population frequencies, but they're much less likely to traverse the whole population and fix.
Oh yeah.
So therefore the polymorphism bar would be higher, and that would make this whole scheme conservative.
Even accounting for slightly if slightly deleterious ones do fix and slightly advantageous have to compensate for it, it's still conservative to that.
Yeah.
But so that was the other way in which this test can be flawed, right? There could be some of these this what we say is a white bar could in fact be slightly deleterious. They don't have a chance to get fixed, right? And so our expectation for the height of this one is too high compared to what it really should be. So then we would undercount how many adaptive ones have happened. But in Drosophila, because you know there are some slightly deleterious ones, and you can try to, you know, there are some ad hoc ways of dealing with it right now. But the fact that you see 30-50% differences suggests that, you know, even if there were a lot of slightly deleterious ones, you have a lot of apparent adaptation. So one other reason to believe that it might be real is that there are several. In different species, in different Drosophila species, this test has been redone, and it kind of consistently shows positive selection. So this kind of purifying selection changing is much stronger now than it was in the past. It's kind of an ad hoc explanation. It's unlikely to be always true whenever you do it in different species. So at least that's one way that you can test. All right, so. But it's true that it could be misleading in some cases, so it would be nice to look for other pieces of evidence. So the other piece of evidence that we wanted to look at is the evidence of selective sweeps, right? So here's the a cartoon of what a selective sweep is. So imagine you have a piece of genomic sequence. Each line is a haplotype sample from the population, and these white circles are polymorphisms. So there is some kind of standing level of polymorphism. You have an adaptive mutation occurring in one of them, and this adaptive mutation, say, is destined to be fixed, and it starts increasing in frequency. As it starts increasing in frequency, it increases in frequency sufficiently fast that recombination does not have time to decouple the fate of this mutation from the polymorphism on the same haplotype where it happened to land. So this is a stochastic event. This mutation could have occurred on any one of these haplotypes. It just happened to occur in this one, and then it drags polymorphisms next to it to high frequency. And it's with time, if, let's say, if recombination rate is zero, then you expect to see the whole haplotype getting fixed. If there is recombination, then the ones that are nearby will, let's say, will either get fixed or will be dragged to very high frequencies. And if you go farther away, the recombination rate is higher, then the fates will get uncoupled and the effect will be smaller. So it's going to be some sort of local reduction of diversity, right? So you can see that there's, in this cartoon, there's no diversity. Local reduction of diversity, and the size of the window in which diversity is reduced is a function of strength of selection on this advantageous mutation and recombination rate. And so proportional to the strength of selection and inversely proportional to the recombination rate. So if adaptation truly is as pervasive as this McDonald-Kreitman test suggests, then one should expect to see quite a few of these selective sweeps. Now, one thing I failed to mention is that so this is what you see right after the selective sweep, right? But then, with time, new neutral mutations will occur nearby, and will obscure this event, right? So there's only a window of time during which you expect to be able to see these selective sweeps. And Molly has a paper which says that you basically should only be able to see them under NE generation. So there's a window of time that's, let's say, NE generations long, and that's actually that's too far back in the past. So you only should be able to see fairly recent selective sweeps. But McDonald-Kreitman has suggested that adaptation is so frequent that there should be enough fairly recent sweeps that you should be able to see them. All right. And so, can we go and look for them? So the picture, if they are recurring, it should be something like this. So imagine that you have genome-wide data. And so this is 20 megabases, which is roughly the size of a Drosophila chromosomal arm. And let's say you somehow were able to get enough data to measure the level of neutral polymorphism. You have neutral sites in the genome, and you measure the level of neutral polymorphism across the chromosome. So there's going to be some kind of fluctuation simply because of drift and stochasticity of the coalescent. And then you start having these selective sweeps. So a single selective sweep, so it should really go down to zero, right on top of the sweep, drags it down to zero, and then it has weakening effects as you go farther from the sweep. And then with time, it starts decaying. The size here is the size of a sweep of a selective advantage of about 1%. So that's the scale. It starts decaying, and then another one happens somewhere else, decays. So this one is a narrow sweep because it's driven by a weaker adaptive mutation, so there's going to be some variability in the size of the sweeps, right? And so if this is happening recurrently, there are recurring selective sweeps, we should see this heterogeneity, and we should be able to extract information about the adaptive process from the heterogeneity. Right? So that's the logic.
Does it also have to worry about the recombination hotspots?
I guess you should worry them. I mean, we can discuss. We need to worry about the recombination rate. I'm not sure necessarily what the hotspots is the worry, but variation recombination rate is something we need to worry about. All right. So
in this picture, that baseline of what you might call neutral polymorphism, you don't really have dropping down. These are pervasive enough.
So they should.
If these yellow
lines overlap, then you start having overall reduction. Just as we started thinking about this, a number of whole genome sequences became available through the efforts of a group at Davis. David Begun and Zheng Lingli were the spearhead of the effort. And the data consists of six Drosophila simulant strains that were sort of shotgun sequenced to variable coverage, 1 to 2 fold. And we also have a complete genome sequence of Drosophila melanogaster. So these two species are sibling species. They're fairly closely related. It's hard to tell them apart. The Drosophila melanogaster has a very well annotated genome, so it's kind of a good scaffold. And so what the group at Davis did was to align the simulant sequences to Drosophila melanogaster, right? And so that's the data we're using. Now, there are gaps in the sequence, and so we did a lot of processing trying to get the estimate of the amount of neutral polymorphism through the genome. If you're interested in kind of the details of how we did it, I can talk about it later. But the bottom line, we have an estimate of the levels of neutral polymorphism so genome-wide from these six strains and the divergence to the Drosophila melanogaster. The levels of neutral polymorphism that we're estimating are estimated based on variation at synonymous sites, right? And we're going to treat them as neutral sites. That's another kind of caveat that we can talk about it later, whether it's important or not. All right, so this is the first picture that one of the first pictures that we got, and we're very excited to see it. So, all right, so what's here? So again, this is the length of the chromosomal arm in mega base pairs. It's chromosome arm 2L. This is the level of neutral polymorphism that we estimate using synonymous sites. And this line is sort of our estimate using certain smoothing procedure that we employ to estimate kind of the level of neutral polymorphism at every site of the genome, not necessarily only at the synonymous sites, everywhere, using synonymous sites in the vicinity. Right? So that's our estimate. And you can see kind of two gross features here. One is kind of this inverted smile. So the level of neutral polymorphism, or what we call neutral polymorphism, is lower at the ends of the chromosomes, kind of higher in the middle. So this pattern had been observed before. It's kind of a classical pattern of Begon and Aquadra. The one possible reason for this is that the rate of recombination in Drosophila is much lower at the tips of the chromosomes. So it's low here and low here, right? And when this pattern was discovered, it was presented as a piece of evidence for recurrent selective sweeps, again, because recurrent selective sweeps should have a stronger effect in regions where recombination rate is lower, right? Each selective sweep will drag a bigger chunk of the chromosome with it, and the window in which polymorphism is reduced will be larger. So the effect should be greater here and here, and that's what we see. There's another phenomenon called background selection, which, we can talk later in conjunction with all of this data. And that would predict exactly the same thing. Yeah?
Just describe a little more detail, just because people may want to play this game. You're estimating neutral polymorphism.
Yeah.
In a window.
Yeah.
And you say it's only silent polymorphism. You actually change the size of the window.
Yeah.
As you slide along. Maybe describe that a little bit, just in case anyone else wants to do it. But most people are familiar with taking some kind of sliding window, or sliding average across.
Well,
but in this case, the window actually changes. It's
In absolute length changes, right? But it doesn't. We have an involved procedure where we look at the window that has a constant number of synonymous sites that have been also adjusted for sort of mutation opportunity, because mutational rate varies in the Drosophila, and we find the window that gives us the best ability to predict polymorphism at other neutral sites. So something I was not planning to talk about. So we use synonymous sites, right? And this is our one neutral standard. We also have sites that are in so-called short introns in Drosophila that are thought to evolve neutrally, like the middles of short introns. So our criteria for how well our, you know, how big the window we should take. Clearly, you don't want to take the window that's too small, because then you have a lot of stochastic noise. You don't want to take the window that's too large, because then you subsume all of the variability that you're looking for, right? So you're trying to find a window that has enough information in it not too big, not too small. So what we did was use an independent reference of variability at intronic sites and try to find a window of the number of synonymous sites on both sides such that our ability to predict the variation at introns nearby is maximized. And we also found that sort of different genes in Drosophila synonymous sites clearly not entirely neutral. So the question for us was whether we should take only synonymous sites in genes that are likeliest to evolve neutralized synonymous sites, so genes without codon bias, so-called. I don't know if people know what codon bias is. So take some of the genes where there's the likeliest possibility they're evolving neutrally, or take all the genes. And it turned out that taking all the genes is better in the sense of being able to predict variability in introns, probably just because even though the data is somewhat dirtier, there's just more of it, and it's better to take all of it than to take only, you know, the cleanest subset. So, in fact,
this is just the coding regions.
Only coding regions. So we're taking coding regions, but Drosophila genome is, like you were mentioning, possibly because there's deletion rate is so high, is very compact. So there's not that much variability in terms of gene density. It's all sort of the intergenic sequences are fairly small, and so that procedure works okay. There are sort of enough synonymous sites in the vicinity of most sites in the genome.
So when you've estimated the window size, how big is it?
What was the size for the map?
I think on average it's something like
40 kb. But it varies in length, right? Because some regions, you need to find enough synonymous sites. So some if places where the gene density is lower, it's going to be bigger.
And this is actually raises another more general point. It's just been my own personal experience. When you start doing these comparative genomic analysis, and you have the ability to compile or pool across many genes and get these patterns, often to find the patterns, it's not an issue of sort of necessarily maximizing all the data in the genome, but rather filtered in some intelligent way where if there's something going on that you're interested in, you're likely to find it. Mm-hmm. Just kind of naively just aligning these genomes and doing it across the entire genome may not have produced, an obvious pattern.
Yeah.
Thinking about what component of the genome really is likely to contain a signal on filtering.
So why is there so much noise on that?
Yeah, so that's the other pattern that just jumps at you, and there's a lot of variability. And it's sort of exactly the kind of variability that we're looking for. That's what we want to say is that a lot of these are sweeps, right? But it's hard to tell whether it's true or not. So first, just to show that in this data there is correlation with recombination rate, the correlation that we expect to see. The lower the recombination, the less polymorphism there is, which is consistent with selective sweeps. It's also consistent with background selection, which we can talk about later. If we look in this kind of smaller window, 500 kb in the middle of the arm, this is what we see. So first, again, we have this very kind of chromosome-wide variation in polymorphism, lower in telomeres and centromeres, kind of on average even in the middle of chromosomes, where the recombination rate is high. If you look at the 500 kb scale, see that there is fluctuation on maybe 50-100 kb scale, and then there's a very small size fluctuation in there as well, right? The kind of very fine scale. And so it's possible that a lot of it is just noise because the amount of data is limited. Right? So the question for us was whether all of it is noise or whether some of it is noise. And to see whether how much of it is noise, we carried out a bootstrapping procedure. So at every site, we used the predicted amount of polymorphism from this line to simulate the data and re-estimate the line right? And we did it, 10,000 times. And so the gray is the 95% confidence intervals around the line that come from the bootstrap. So they tell you how much data you have in order to estimate the line. Yeah.
I'm a little confused about your window size. I thought window size was 30 kb.
No, so at each point, right, each point here, you go at each point in the genome, you go left and right to symmetrically, right? So just to until you count certain number of synonymous sites, right?
Just which roughly
40 kb.
Kb.
40 kb.
And the scale there is.
So this is 500 kb.
So naively, I would have thought that if our window size is averaging over, mm-hmm. so 10% of this whole range, why actually are we seeing so much fine structure?
So maybe I'm misunderstanding. All of this is just noise.
Okay.
Right, but you move the window and you start, you have a slightly different estimate. Right, they're overlapping windows, right?
Exactly.
Right. So. But the bootstrap tells us that all of this wiggling is just noise, just not enough data, so we're not interested in it. It's just basically noise. But these larger wiggles appear to be real, at least to the extent that there's enough data to estimate them. So far, so good?
Yeah. Can I just check about the definition of theta s? The fraction of synonymous size that are polymorphic.
It's a Watterson's theta, so it's number of polymorphs and synonymous sites with their parameter that depends on how many sequences there are. We actually subsampled all of the sequences to 4, so there's a consistent depth of coverage. So if we have less than 3 sequences, right, because of a shotgun, we throw away that site. If there are more than, if there's 4, we keep all 4. If there are 5, we randomly keep 4. And so the depth of coverage is the same. And so theta S is Watterson's theta, which is, you know, how many synonymous sites are there per, how many polymorphs are there per synonymous site in the window? You know, multiply, divided by like 1.5 or something like that.
So is a fair restatement of what you've been doing to say that these big humps are invariant under changes of the window size around what you actually chosen, that they would persist if you take 2/3 or
the size of the window.
Of the window. And
well, I think they will be dependent on the window.
The whole thing with say half the window size, then probably that if you say the small wiggles are random, they would be changed, but the big ones would be more or less the same. Is that fair to say?
Well, if you take a smaller window, you will add, you know, sampling noise. Right, so I'm not sure whether with this size of the window, right, with this amount of sampling noise, we can estimate reliably this.
Yeah, I can see that. If you make the window shorter, you get more sampling noise. If you make the window longer, you get less resolution.
That's right.
And you choose some kind of optimum. But my question is, so how stable is it with respect to variations of the method around that optimum?
I don't know whether we haven't varied the window, right, Guy?
Did we look at different window sizes? We may have, but I don't remember anything particular. So,
I mean, it's probably going to change.
What would happen? You would take a smaller one, you would get more noise. You would take a larger one, you would get less noise, but you would smoothen the true heterogeneity as well.
So I guess the point here is that we seem to be able to detect these with this amount of data. Whether it's stable to the window size, we don't know. But you see later, that's not where we get the signal from. Yeah.
These are from coalescent simulations, right?
I think these are just binomial, right? So you have the synonymous sites, you have the probability of the site being polymorphic, and just sample. There's no coalescent. Right. Why would you need to do a coalescent?
No, it's just kind of every time I've seen this graph before, but looking at it, I was wondering why the black line isn't always like roughly kind of in the middle of the gray scatter. You know, like, why don't you see noise above the estimate as well as below? Like, for example, 10.1, the black line is kind of hugging the top and kind of looks like outside of the 95% control. I was trying to figure out why.
Well, because, right, so this site, I mean, I have no idea.
Yeah, yeah.
But this site is looking, you're looking at the synonymous sites in the vicinity. So if this just happened to be a very high estimate, but at the sites that will contribute to the estimate, your estimate was very low, right? So in resampling, it'll just bring it down. Something like that, but
yeah. By the way, if you have 100 estimates, you would expect it in 5 of the 100 anyway that something like this happens.
That's very uncommon. Yeah.
I just expecting it to be more
because it's not bootstrapping at that site, right? So you bootstrap at all the sites and then you redo the procedure.
Yeah. The simulation is what I mean. You just think how many sites you have. You take the probability of being
more. Yes. Yeah. No. So right. So we have this black line, right? So then at each synonymous site in the genome, we have our predicted probability of it being polymorphic. So we sample from it. We get a new polymorphous data set, right? On that polymorphous data set, we repeat the procedure of estimating that the line, right? And then at each site we have a new estimate, and we do it enough times to get the bootstrap sleeve. So just it all we're doing is looking at kind of the binomial part of it.
That's it.
Okay. There's just nothing else. So yeah. Do we have enough data?
So it's binomial.
It's just binomial.
And as an aside, if you actually did try to use a coalescent simulation to estimate these intervals, they're not symmetric.
Yeah, we did a coalescent simulation. You know, the data. The problem with coalescent simulations, you don't know what coalescent simulations to do because. If the population size was constant and everything was phonetic, everything would be easy, but it's not, because it's not, that by itself can generate a lot of variability. And so, you know, we did do phonetic coalescent simulations, but then we weren't sure what to do with them because they don't really, other than the yardstick, they don't help.
But isn't that addressing a different question? I mean, these measures of uncertainty are just to give you a sense of how well you're estimating theta S, whereas coalescent simulations.
Absolutely. That's right.
Different kind of variance and evolutionary variance.
That's right. So one question would be, do you expect these wiggles simply from the fact that the evolution process is stochastic? So when we do that, we find that the amount of variability is too great if your evolutionary process was simple. But because evolution process is not simple, because of demography, it's not clear whether it's relevant. Right. Okay, so why is there so much heterogeneity? So selective sweeps is one, and these are kind of three other possibilities that we'll discuss now, ignoring again background selection for the time being. Okay, so selective sweeps, that's what we were hoping to see, and that's kind of what we are looking for signatures of. The other straightforward explanations would be sort of mutualist explanations. One possibility is that some regions are just more prone to mutation, and that's why you have these dips and valleys. Some genes are under stronger constraint, right? So we're using synonymous sites, and as I said before, they're not entirely mutual, so maybe they're kind of clustering on genes with similar codon bias. Actually, there is some evidence that that's true. And the final one is kind of demography, what people call demography, which is the population history of the species is non-equilibrium. Most likely they have expanded out of Africa and the rest of the world, went through a bottleneck, and bottlenecks themselves could generate a lot of variability in polymorphisms. So some kind of roughly some polymorphisms can get through the bottleneck by chance, and some of them don't, right? So you have reduction of polymorphism and it's going to generate variability through the genome. So all of these probably contribute to the variability. And so we want to see whether there is a signal there of positive selection. All right, so the signal we're looking for is the following. So imagine, you again, if you go back to a single selective sweep, and a single selective sweep does two things, right? So you have a functional mutation that goes to fixation, right? And the functional mutation that goes to fixation should generate, should add to the counts of divergence between species, right? So it happened recently, and it increased the amount of divergence at functional sites. So if, let's say, we assume that that adaptation happens at amino acid coding sites, most of it within proteins, then a single selective sweep should increase the amount of amino acid divergence between the two species that we're looking at, between simulans and nonagaster, right? At the same time, it's a selective sweep, it reduces neutral polymorphism. So they go in opposite directions. It increases functional divergence and reduces neutral polymorphism. So if we look genome-wide, we should see a negative correlation between the level of amino acid divergence, so kind of, or in a steady state, how often selective sweeps happen in this region, and neutral polymorphism. The correlation should be negative. If we have hotspots of mutation, then under neutrality, both neutral polymorphism and functional divergence should go up, right? Because the number of neutral mutations will increase. So correlation should be positive. If the constraint is stronger, then likely there's going to be positive correlation again, because the genes that have stronger constraint on amino acid sequences tend also to be more constrained at synonymous sites. So again, the correlation should be positive. Now, demography is, so at least that's the argument, demography is something that can affect it's something, so recent events, they're likely to generate a lot of noise in your polymorphism, something that tells you about recent history of the species. And it can, some regions should go up, some regions should go down. But the important thing is that it's unlikely that demographic events should affect divergence between species, because that's a much longer time scale. So demography will introduce noise into the system, but it should not generate correlation by itself. It's something kind of the mock through which we will try to see whether there is signature of positive selection.
Well, the same thing is true. The number of tRNAs in your two species are considered.
No.
The number of
tRNAs is not. It's not. Simulans has more.
So why the coding bias should be constant?
It does not have to be constant. The only thing is that genes that have stronger constraint on amino acid sites also tend to have stronger constraint at synonymous sites. So, right, so coding bias is higher in those genes. So if, let's say, to the extent that there is constraint at synonymous sites that we're not taking into account, it will generate positive correlation at the local scale, right? The gene is constrained at amino acid site, it has a small number of differences between species. Amino acid sites, and also should have little polymorphism on the sides because they're constrained as well. There's no constancy here. You don't need constancy. All you need is that they're correlated positively rather than negatively.
I mean, it's fair to say that this is really just an empirical observation. People have found it in many different comparisons, not just for software, that there is a positive correlation between KS and KA.
Well, and actually, I'll show you. There's a very strong positive correlation in this data. It's like 0.3 plus.
But I don't know, whether there's a good explanation for it. There's perhaps been a few papers where people have tried to investigate why that is. It's,
yeah.
In some sense, surprising. Maybe you guys have an explanation, but it is an empirical observation.
Yeah.
Perhaps unexplained. But strong enough that it really deserves.
And those that drive these correlations, they're mostly highly expressed, low expressed.
Yeah.
Most
of the coding biases are highly expressed genes. Actually, highly expressed genes and also genes that are expressed at particular times of development. And.
But it's also found in mammalian genes too, right? The K.
Yeah. That's a little harder.
Composition difference, but
yeah, that, double mutations could do it. There are many reasons for why it could be the case. But it's hard to imagine that constraint would work in an anti-correlated way. right? Just that's a little less intuitive. So again, there's no data for it.
Joseph Cormoran's going to be in a week or two. He's written about this in Quanta. When he's here, he's going to have an answer.
Yeah. So at least for these ones, the predictions are a positive correlation, no correlation, and negative correlation only comes out when you look at recurrent selective sweeps. So that's the data. All right, so what is shown here? So again, so this is neutral polymorphism. This is the count of amino acid, the number of differences between malignus and simulans. Now we're looking at windows of 100 kb. So we have our map, and we move the window of 100 kb through all of that, through autosomes. We don't look at the sex chromosome, and at each 100 kb window, we can look at the neutral polymorphism in that window, and the number of differences between malignus and simulans. And then we pull the windows that have the same count of amino acid differences, right? So we think, I don't know how many windows there are here, but we pull them into this classes just to show the relationship a little bit more cleanly. And as you can see, it's a fairly strong relationship. The difference is not that great, so it goes from 0.033 to 0.027 from regions that have very little amino acid difference to those that have a lot. But it's a monotonic relationship, and now if you look at the unpooled data, the correlation, regression is minus 0.14, so it doesn't explain a lot of variation, but there is clear statistically significant signal in there. All right.
Actually, if you go back to the actual data slide where you showed that window, 500 kb or something, because you say this is looking across 100 kb windows.
Okay.
Yeah, that one. And this is, you're saying 500 kb?
This is 500 kb, yeah.
Actually, okay. It's not obvious here. Over 100 kb windows where you're actually generally including regions that go up and down.
Yeah, so there are overlapping windows, right? And so they do go up and down, but it, overall, windows that have lower levels of polymorphism tend to have higher level of functional divergence. Sorry. Marcus' fault. All right.
Suppose you didn't use windows, but you had genes. Suppose a gene was a unit.
We can talk about it. I guess Peter will talk about the data where you start from with the gene as a unit. And I'll talk a little bit about that. Right. So the next prediction I wanted to test, and it will be important for the inference part of this work. We wanted to see whether there's something about the shape of this curve that's predicted under recurrent selective sweeps will also be seen in the data. So we devised this statistic called Q, which is the ratio between a minimum level of polymorphism in a window to the mean. And the notion is that under a model of selective sweeps, if you have selective sweeps, then it's going to drag, so it's going to have this shape where the minimum is going to be below the mean, right? And we already know that the mean goes down overall, but we wanted to see what the minimum divided by the mean will also go down. Now, because mean goes down and mean here is in the denominator, kind of all things being equal, Q should go up, at least from this correlation. Now, what you would expect under neutrality and so forth is hard to predict, but under model of selective sweeps, you do expect Q to go down as the rate adaptation goes up. So this is Q, And again, using the same exact procedure, using 100 KB windows, in each window, you find the minimum. The minimum you get find from that line that we estimated, right? So that's our minimum. And then we have the average. And you can see that that line is also goes monotonically down. The regression is much stronger than for just the mean. You know, again, p-values are very low just because there's so much data here. Okay? So kind of two independent predictions all seem to pan out. Well, again, there should be a lot of noise there, right? So for example, demography. Right. Demography, sampling noise, you know, all of these sources of noise, variation and constraint, variation mutation rate, all of these things should either introduce noise or should actually give you positive correlation. So what we're able to see is something that, despite all of these, all of the noise and positive effects, we can see the negative correlation through it.
Plus, you're only using as a measure of functional divergence, not synonymous mutations.
That's right.
So anything that's regulatory.
That's correct. Yeah, it's hard to tell why this is a better, right? So actually, do you have anything to say why Q correlates better than theta?
Yeah, I don't know. Q has some troubling statistical properties, I think the intuition of sweeps is that you expect a very sharp reduction around the adaptive substitution, and less in the background. So it's a particular thinking about what sweeps does. It's maybe more.
I guess I'm asking more why the same amount of data you have so much difference.
Well, maybe so. One possibility is that Q is driven by the places where there's truly a sweep, where the minimum is hitting very close to zero, and then it doesn't really matter what the mean is, right? So even though you don't estimate it well, you can estimate sort of zero well, or something close to zero, something like that. But I don't know. It's not been simulated, right? We don't have a simulation of the adaptive process that would tell us what the statistical properties of these things are. And the guy is alluding. It's just minimum is a troubling measure. All right. So now the nice thing, and so one reason, so Q was devised, is that it contains information. So if you have both the mean and this minimum and the minimum, they have different information about the process of this recurring selective sweeps. All right. So if you look at the before we go there, so Molly.
Oh, sorry.
All right. So they have different information. And the information is that if you look at a wide selective sweep like this that has 200, 300 kb, then in that sweep, the minimum is the same as in a weaker sweep, right? They kind of, in principle, they should both go down to zero, right on top of the adaptive mutation. So the minimum kind of stays the same independently of the strength of selection. But the mean should be affected differently, right? So the mean goes down more when selection is stronger. So if you all you have is the mean, then I'll show some formula later. There's no way to separate the rate and the strength of positive selection. They show up as the product. So the rate multiplied by the strength, they all go together. And because you can have fewer sweeps, but they're stronger, and the average reduction stays the same. It's not the same for the minimum. Minimum, if you just sort of look at the minima, it counts number of sweeps a little bit better, right? And so you bear the number of minima that happened in the recent past just depends on the rate of positive selection, does not depend on the strength. And, I mean, it depends on the strength in the sense that we have a limited amount of data. We're unlikely to notice a weak selective sweep, maybe because it's just it's too narrow. We don't have enough SNPs to tell it. But in principle, that measure itself should be affected by the count, not by the strength. All right. So we wanted to see, before we sort of did the inference using Q and the theta, the average, wanted to see whether there is any evidence of strong positive selection in the data, right? So whether there are these large sweeps in there. And first we did this kind of permutation procedure to look for it. So that the logic there was the following. And so that goes to the size of a gene. So if you have a lot of strong sweeps, then the neutral polymorphism should be determined by how many sweeps are happening in a fairly wide window, let's say 100 kV, right? You, as a neutral site, you're feeling sweeps fairly far away from you. And therefore, the level of polymorphism should depend on how many sweeps have happened, let's say, in a 50 kV window, 100 kV window in the recent past. And therefore, what matters to you is, at least statistically here, is the amount of divergence in the large window. If all of the sweeps are weak like this, then the only thing that matters to you are sweeps that are happening right nearby. You decouple from anything that happens, let's say, 100 kV away. It doesn't matter, because all of the sweeps can only affect things locally. So to see whether it was one way or the other, we did this permutation. Telegon, 5 kV shuffle. So we split the data in 5 kV pieces, and then for each piece, we looked at the kind of the amount of polymorphism in that window, synonymous polymorphism, and the non-synonymous divergence in that 5 kV window. Then we found another window that had the same amount of non-synonymous divergence as this one. So say A was moved here because this window and this window had the same amount of non-synonymous divergence in that 5 kV window. And 5 kV is the sort of size of a gene, roughly. So we move it here, and we move the whole window. So we move both the polymorphism and divergence there. So once we do the shuffle, then the non-synonymous divergence and the distribution of non-synonymous divergences through the windows does not change, because you swap windows that have the same exact non-synonymous divergence. And if the effects were always local, you also did not change anything about the distribution of the effect of non-synonymous divergence on synonymous polymorphism, right? Because you move the things together. If, on the other hand, the effects are more global, kind of 50 kB, 100 kB, then we just killed the correlation, right? Because we decoupled the amount of polymorphism from the divergence in the bigger window. Does that make sense? Okay. So when we do this, here's what we find. So first, this is something that Marty alluded to already, we do have a correlation between the rate of synonymous evolution and the rate of non-synonymous evolution. So the divergence per site at synonymous sites and divergence per site at non-synonymous sites. That correlation is positive, very strong, right? We were saying, so probably due to the variation in constraint, non-synonymous and synonymous sites. It's 0.35. After we did the shuffle, the correlation does not change, right? It stays the same. So at least for that correlation, which should be operating due to forces at the level of the gene, nothing got messed up. When we look at theta, so the mean polymorphism, synonymous polymorphism versus the number of differences, then we start from minus 0.14. After the shuffle, the correlation disappears. So this difference is highly significant. And when we do it for Q, it disappears as well. It goes from minus 0.55 to minus 0.012. So at least that, using this procedure, we seem to get a sense that the effects that we're seeing are more global in nature than just 5 kV. So as far as the level of polymorphism is concerned, it's important to know how much non-synonymous divergence has happened in a bigger window than 5 kb, maybe 50 kb or 100 kb, right? So at least some evidence that some of the sweeps are strong. So there's some strong positive selection. All right, so again, so we then use a procedure to estimate the strength and the rate of positive selection using these two statistics, mean and the Q, and their relationship with non-synonymous divergence. All right, so that's still a little bit of math. Well, this formula that we're used for estimation, they are derived from, so let's see. So this one is derived from the pseudo-hitchhiking model of selective sweeps. And the bottom line, so rho here is the rate of recombination. Nu is the rate of adaptation per generation. S is the strength of selection on individual adaptive substitution. And this is a function that depends only on the population size. Right? So the level of polymorphism that you expect is a function, again, of the combination rate and the product of the rate of adaptation and selection coefficient. So it comes up this way. And to estimate the minimum, the estimation there assumes that we can't find the site where adaptation happened. And it happens within sort of certain window of time, and the amount of time that it happened ago depends on the rate of adaptation, right? The higher the rate of adaptation, the closer to the present it's likely to have happened, and therefore the minimum is likely to be easy to detect. So, and the minimum becomes is a function of population size, the rate of adaptation, not the strength, and the window size. Right, W is the window size. So is there an adaptation that happened in the window? So nu is the rate of adaptation per nucleotide, and so you're interested in whether adaptation happened anywhere in your window, and that's going to be a minimum. Again, Q is the ratio of the two. So we have the regression of theta versus dn, and we have Q versus dn. And so, in principle, you should have information to estimate both the rate and the strength of adaptation independently. Just on the side, another way you can do it is use just this relationship, and then estimate the rate of adaptation nu from McDonald-Crichton tables, right? Not internal to the data, but just use McDonald-Crichton table, and I guess Peter will talk about those approaches. I'm just going to skip this. So using this, the estimates are the following. The rate of adaptation is roughly 1 in 1,000 generations. I think it's maybe 3,000 generations, I think, right? So it's a typo. 1 every 3,000 generations per genome, from our estimation. And that's about maybe 10, 20 times lower than McDonald-Crichton estimates. So the strength of selection that we estimate is very high. It's sort of like 1%, which is whopping by Drosophila standards. So NES is on the order of 10 to the fourth, right? So it's a very, very, very large number. And our estimate of the reduction of neutral polymorphism genome-wide due to adaptation, and this is true.
In higher combination regions,
just to kind of the part where the reduction will be weaker, is 15%. So it's a significant force.
Did you mention that you can just infer something like the product of rate of adaptation and selection strength?
No. So you if you just use this. Right, so theta, the level of polymorphism, depends on the product. But the minimum depends just on the rate. Right? By the way, so just Guy pointed out, all of this was done only in regions of high recombination. Right? So we cut out anything that has low recombination rate just because it's different there. So all of these estimates are done for high recombination rate regions. right? So quite significant, and it was nice to see that the rate was lower than the McDonald-Kreutzmann rate, because it's likely that we're missing a lot of adaptations, and specifically adaptations that have a weak selection effect are more likely to be missed. So it's possible that a large number of adaptations have weak selection effect, but from this, we would say that 5% of adaptations. So if you believe McDonald-Kreutzmann rates and say McDonald-Kreutzmann tells you how many adaptations have happened, and then our rate is about 20 times smaller, and the selection coefficient is 1%, well, kind of roughly 5% of adaptations have this selection coefficient, and 95% have smaller, and we don't see them. Right. Yeah.
So I still don't understand whether this is big or small. If I'm going to say compare G protein sequences from two different species, what fraction of those are the adapted ones, and what fraction of the...
Well, so McDonald-Kreutzmann tells us that it's 30 to 50% in Drosophila, right? And what we would say, well, it's hard to tell because our procedure mixes up all adaptations that happen in the window, both in genes and non-genes. But, you know, maybe they say that 5% of that 50%, so whatever, a few percent of those are strongly adapted.
So, Dimitri, shouldn't the rate for protein evolution should be 5% of that rate?
Sorry, can you say it again?
Or sorry, it should be 20% of that rate or something.
That's what I'm saying.
I don't think so. So the only, if you assume that adaptations at non-coding regions, because this is based on the association between polymorphism and non-synonymous substitutions or amino acid substitutions in a window, so if you assume that the rate of adaptive evolution in non-coding DNA is not correlated with the rate in genes, then this should only reflect the adaptations in genes. If you assume that for some reason they're correlated, not that that's unlikely, then this could also reflect.
Yeah, so that would be we're counting all adaptations, coding, non-coding. We're using coding, the amount of divergence, as our proxy, right? But any dip is going to be counted as an adaptation. So, you know, something, and it's 5% of all of the five to, I don't know, if they're equally likely and perfectly correlated, then it will be 2.5%. I don't know. Just it's hard to tell.
I guess I'm also struggling to understand whether that's a big or a small number. So can I sort of think of so suppose we want to do an experiment in the lab, and we want to put a bunch of flies on some selective pressure and ask how many generations we need. So am I basically seeing that we need 1,000 flies and more or less one generation?
1,000 flies what?
And we need 1,000 flies and basically one generation to start seeing something?
To start seeing, well, so it's a...
To start seeing a change in the phenotype.
Well, no. So this is the rate, 1,000, it's substitutions per genome, right? So it's one successful adaptation. If you're interested in mutations, and there are 1%, then 1% of the adaptive mutations will get fixed. So that supposes the rate of adaptive mutation that's actually quite high per genome. You need 10 flies, and there will be an adaptive mutation, but will not fix. Yeah.
But a mutation with a 1% selective advantage will go through the population, sort of on the reciprocal of that selective advantage.
That's right. So the amount of time.
100 generations.
The
estimate is one substitution for several thousand generations.
Yeah.
Then, kind of, on average, there isn't one of those on its way to fixation in the genome.
Well, all of this is like should be taken with a big grain of salt. I mean, 1% is some kind of a, like we're assuming that all adaptive mutations have the same, adaptive substitutions have the same selective coefficient. There could be great variation of them, and kind of, I don't know what that procedure, what kind of a averaging it does. to get you this 1%. And I know about it. Yeah.
But also, I mean, Marty, it's not obvious to me. I mean, we don't know what the genetic architecture of these adaptations are, right? So if you actually imposed a selective pressure on Drosophila, who knows how many of these alleles could solve the problem? So, I mean, it's not obvious to me to get from that to a waiting time till your adaptation is met by a mutation, because for that, you also need to know the target size. It could be that all of the adaptations in Drosophila 1, I guess, are solving how to survive winter in Europe or something. For all we know, right? I mean, I don't know. It's just not obvious to me how you get from this to a waiting time.
I think that's actually not unlikely. Honestly, I'm not. Could be all temperate.
Waiting time in the lab, or
waiting time in the lab.
If you set up an experiment like that, how long would you have to wait to see an adaptation?
Yeah.
Probably not very long.
I mean, this rate in the wild may be completely different from the rate that you would see in the lab.
Well, but mutation rate. Why would it be different?
Well, because depending on what kind of selection pressure you use.
Well, selection pressure, which is Molly was saying, but if you knew the selection pressure, then the rate of that mutation should be sort of similar, right?
Right, but I guess I was just referring to the same thing. If in the lab you don't put winters but something else, then
you
would get it.
All right, so do I have any more time?
Yeah, so again, the method itself is restricting you to make these estimates only for very strong.
That's right. So I guess the bottom line is that there is evidence of strong adaptation. We're not seeing anything about that there is a lack of weak adaptations.
Right. But anyway, that 1% selective advantage in no way reflects the distribution of selective advantage.
No.
Just for your method.
That's right.
You sort of can detect ones of that order, and for those you estimate there's one.
That's right.
Absolutely. I mean, I guess that's the interesting, or one of the interesting aspects, that the method is really complementary in the window of selection coefficients that it's good at.
That's right.
And that's exactly complementary to the polymorphism spectrum based method. So they're not at all contradictory. They're just measuring different.
That's right.
Different kinds of the distribution.
That's right. Well, I mean, I guess in defense, I could say like if there's no strong positive selection, our rate would have been zero. We would not have been able to see that correlation.
In fact, maybe one could say that if there's a question mark on the last line, because if there is this pervasive moderate selection, then this amount of polymorphism that you see as a baseline may not be neutral, but it may be sort of the additional reduction of that polymorphism due to the heavy sweeps.
I'm not sure that's true, because the theta part is going to be affected by everything, right? We estimate 1% because we have theta and Q, we have the minimum. But if we just looked at the theta, right, so that correlation with Dn is affected by everything, strong and weak. So, and that's our kind of reduction. Does that make sense? So the average should be affected by everything. We're not missing that part. That's part of the data.
No, I'm just saying.
Theta in large windows.
We are measuring theta in large windows, but it's average theta, right? So weak sweeps will take out, it will lower the mean. I don't see why they would not have an effect on theta. I mean, we can measure. This is just averaging.
But it's again, the 15% is taken when you take into account the functional dependence on Dn.
That's right. But I'm just saying. So. Well, I mean, that's kind of my sense that, right. So that line should be affected. That should be affected both by strong and weak sweeps. There's no reason for why these should only be affected by strong ones. I mean, weak sweeps will eliminate, will eliminate polymorphism in the smaller windows. But when we average over 100 qubit window, we have that effect. Where would it go?
So you're saying you shouldn't attribute that 15%
So strong, no. No, I think it's to everything. 15% is everything.
But so strong sweeps have a stronger signature you need here because they take along a larger window. So if you only look at a very slow sweep has like a 5 kb window and it really doesn't contribute much to the reduction in variation.
Well, they will not contribute to the reduction variation because they're weak. But if their rate is, let's say, if each one of them is 5 kb, but there are 20 times as many of them, then they will contribute just as much. So if that's our notion right now, that weak sweeps are more common, but we just don't see them for the minimum. I think that's like the Q will not be affected by them. Just it's hard for them to capture them, but the average should be affected.
Well, I mean, if they're weakened but much more numerous, then one may enter a regime where they start to interact. So one of them starts, and then you are in this regime which we've been discussing last week quite a bit in this clonal interference thing, and then of course this whole picture.
It's not clear because the weak ones are narrow, right? So they have a very narrow range of effect. So.
I agree, but I mean, I don't know, but it's just not clear whether they're talking to each other.
Well, the interference is actually, in a funny way, the interference is, if you assume that the reduction in polymorphism is the same, then the interference is about the same, because the reduction in polymorphism, at least the mean of it, depends on this compound parameter, which is the rate times the strength of the sweep. And actually, this compound parameter is something that appears to be the most robust part of the inference procedure, or the reduction in effective population size, because that turns out, so we get a very similar reduction to what Peter gets, which gets a similar reduction to what we and Stefan got, so and it's less sensitive for the details. But also the rate times the strength is because that appears in the formulas for the reduction. So if you increase the rate by 2 and reduce the strength by 2, then you would get the same amount of overlap somehow.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure that the interference is going to be an issue here. However, one thing I want to point out about this is that all the other parameters we're estimating, which is not the reduction in the effective population size, I would take with a huge grain of salt. I think we're only taking the very first steps in the inference procedures here, and I wouldn't put a lot of stock on any of the numbers. And just to make that point, so Peter, for example, does the estimation on the level of genes rather than 100 kb windows, and he gets a selective coefficient which is orders of magnitude lower. And even to be a bit more worrisome, even though when you calculate the spatial scale on which the sweep is supposed to reduce polymorphism, using Peter's estimate, you get a spatial scale which is on the scale of the gene on which he measures the correlation. When you calculate the spatial scale based on our estimate, where we do it in 100 kb windows, we get something like 40 kb, which is on the scale of the 100 kb window where we do the inference. So I think that in order to, how would I say this gently, so in order to be more trustworthy of these numbers, we really need to do something more sophisticated, taking into account the spatial scales that are generating these.
I guess I don't find it as worrisome. I don't see why it's worrisome.
But can say the same thing in your picture. So if, for example, due to the multiple weak sweeps, the overall level, this is what you were mentioning before, mm-hmm. if the overall level was starting to get down, then we would be in this correlated scenario.
We wouldn't be, because the weak sweeps will not affect each other, right?
No, I really agree with
why?
But, you know, when you have a lot of weak sweeps, then there are some additional interesting dynamics that become important.
But I guess
you're really talking about a different feature, like this Hill Robertson effect.
Yeah.
Because my crude understanding of when you have a lot of these simultaneous weak sweeps, then it's this kind of clonal interference. But then, you know, what happens sometimes, if you can get chromosomes that happen to pile up a bunch of these positively selected weeks, they start going through much faster. And then they break up and go slower. But then when you have all these simultaneous ones, the variance in that process starts increasing. And so there's a reduction in the population size just due to that kind of increased variance in the dynamics of the process, as opposed to just a regular like, sweep that goes through some characters of brain. So
but they,
when there's this interference or things like that, then the variance in the rates start coming into play and understanding the
I think Michael was referring, I wasn't here, but he was probably referring to Daniel Fisher's talk. And I think that the numbers in bacteria, just because of the population size, are much, much larger. So having simultaneous sweeps at the same time, well, specifically in E. coli, I also don't know how much recombination you have.
None.
Is another
yeah.
issue. Here, when you look at, when you try to calculate how likely two sweeps are to overlap, even with the McDonald-Kreitman estimates, which are on the high end, and taking a selective coefficient of, say, 1 in 1,000 or something like that, then at least when you assume they're randomly, the overlapping time of a sweep within the distance where they affect each other just turns out to be pretty low.
Yeah. But I guess.
Yeah. But then you have a lot of synonymous polymorphisms.
So actually, I don't know.
That are under weak selection, and there can be many of them in a single gene.
So that type of interference.
Weak selection, that's deleterious,
likely.
Yeah. So with deleterious mutations, and specifically weak mutation interference, then.
But also.
Exactly, I'm not sure whether. Because I think that this independence of the sweep at the moment is the most questionable part. I mean, if we are finding similar rates of these weak sweeps than peer finds, and with the selection coefficients that we attribute to them, it's just marginal whether they touch each other. So that's, in my opinion, the most shaky part is it's not at all a concern for these strong ones. They are well isolated, and it's absolutely justified to treat them as individual objects.
Why would the weak ones be more concerning?
Because there are many more.
But the window over which they affect.
Yeah, but this is a quantitative question. Whether it's the shrinkage of the window and the increase of the number.
Well,
But the width is of the order of the selective coefficient divided by the mutation rate.
A recombination rate.
And the reduction in effective population size just depends on the rate times the selective coefficient. So I think the parameter that matters is just the rate times the selective coefficient to first approximation.
Well, I think it could be a problem if this interference leads to reduction in the rate of adaptation, right? So there might be interference, and they just don't end up counting into the McDonald-Crichton test. If we do have all of the adaptation in the McDonald-Crichton test, then they will not interfere.
But exactly, if they interfere.
That's right. No, but I was just saying. So I think what Guy and I are saying is that
because things can be consistent without interfering, but it doesn't mean that they're true. Because exactly, if they interfere, then by clonal interference, we are underestimating their amount. Because we start seeing only the driving ones.
That's a possibility, as far as I'm concerned. I don't know the dynamic there.
Are we underestimating the mutation rate towards adaptive mutations, or their fixation rate?
Fixation rate cannot be. Mutation rate could be. Like, there could be a lot of interfering sweeps, but they should not end up counting to the divergence.
You'll underestimate the selection coefficient as well.
Underestimate the selection coefficient.
The other extreme was, I agree, this was the other extreme, this was this bacterial scenario that we were hearing about, for example, from Daniel Fisher. So there, it's like then you have just the strong ones driving the ones, and lots of other ones are just carried around by hitchhiking, and is essentially rendering their dynamics neutral.
And so that was the extreme correlated scenario, and this is the uncorrelated scenario. And it just may be that Drosophila, I'm just asking a question, I don't really have a strong opinion myself here, but maybe that Drosophila is in between. There are correlations in that. I don't think that any of this analysis still proves that they're not.
In regions of low recombination, I think that there could be in interference. I think in the regions of very high recombination, which is what we're looking at here, it's so internally consistent that they will, like, you assume no interference, and then you look at the numbers and you plug the numbers back, and there's no interference.
That kind of goes to his point, though, because he's saying Drosophila is on the borderline, and if recombination rates vary, you know, tenfold in the genome or something, that means we're on the borderline.
Yeah, and there might be regions. It also could be that adaptations are not randomly distributed through the genome, and they're, you know, they keep happening in the same gene right next to each other, and who knows? So it's all right. Just
how much more?
Just the same data.
You want to take a break for 10 minutes? Let's take a break.
Okay. Very similar study in humans. We took the polymorphism data from two different data sets. So it's old slide. So there was data from Perligent SNP data. Where SNPs were discovered using a panel of individual using these very large DNA chips, kind of resequencing using chips. And also another data set here is the genome of Jim Watson has been resequenced, the diploid genome, and so we looked at the SNPs that are present in Jim Watson's DNA sequence, and that's our other source of SNPs, and they give very similar results. So it's because in all of the human population, it's the question of SNP ascertainment is a big problem. So just to start off by saying that it's not dependent on the SNP ascertainment. All right, so we're using polymorphisms within humans, divergence with chimp. And so here, just very quickly, I'll just show you the data. So the first prediction of recurrent selective sweeps and playground selection is that there's going to be a positive correlation between polymorphism and recombination rate. So here, showing is the rate of recombination in different windows. Here we're using 400 kb windows, just larger windows than in Drosophila. D nu is the number of differences between the human one human sequence and the chimp sequence. We're using just the number of differences. We're looking only at what we call neutral sequences in the human genome, so we exclude all genic sequences, all sequences near genes, and also all sequences that can be aligned with a very distantly related organism, with zebrafish. So any sequence that can be aligned with zebrafish we consider to be strongly constrained, and when they're outside of genes, we treat them as proxies for regulatory regions, for enhancers, right? So sequences that are outside of these constrained regions, conserved regions, and genic sequences are what we call neutral, right? And so these are our proxies of neutral polymorphisms, neutral divergence. So again, d nu is the number of differences between humans and chimps per neutral site, so right? And that's the estimate both of mutation rate and constraint. That's what Marty called neutral mutation rate. And it does go up with the recombination rate, most likely because recombination rate, recombination itself is mutagenic. So regions of high recombination have high mutation rate, and so you increase the divergence. And you can see there's a kind of a more or less linear relationship with recombination. So if we look at theta nu, which is sort of, this is a measure of amount of polymorphism, and that's the number of SNPs in Perlichan data or in this Jim Watson data per neutral site in that region. And that also increases with recombination rate, but as you can see, it increases curvilinearly. And when you do partial correlation of this versus this, the relationship remains, and this is just for graphical purposes, this is P nu, which is the ratio of theta nu divided by D nu, right? So this is just trying to take out variation in mutation rate or neutral mutation rate from the estimate of theta nu, and it has this curvilinear relationship. So that's a kind of the first signature of you know, recurring selective sweeps all by ground selection. Seems to be there. The fact that it's curvilinear like this is very encouraging because that's what recurring selective sweeps all by ground selection predict, that most of the effect should be in the regions of low recombination and the effect should become weaker as the recombination rate goes up. Right? Yeah.
Your suggestion that this slight increase in you might be because recombination itself is mutagenic.
Yeah.
Is that just a hand-waving argument, or is there actually experimental evidence for that?
There's experimental evidence in yeast that suggests that recombination might be mutagenic because the polymerase used to fill the breaks has lower fidelity, but it's mostly from mitosis in yeast, some circumstantial evidence from meiosis in yeast, and nothing more direct than that.
There's been a long-standing argument whether actually, you know, recombination may actually reduce mutation rates.
So
by bringing all these repair hands on.
Yeah, but so my understanding of that literature is that that's this minimum efficiency processing segments, and so the argument is that if you have a heterozygote base pair within maybe 200 or 300 base pairs, it's a problem. So in humans, it seems like that's unlikely to be an issue, but maybe in Drosophila, certainly in prokaryotes, that might play a role.
Right. All right. So the next signature we looked at is the relation between diversity and gene density. Right. So in Drosophila, I mentioned that gene density doesn't vary that much, so we didn't look for it. But in humans, gene density varies a lot. There are many regions that are completely devoid of genes, and some regions that have quite a few genes. I mean, like I think the average, like 2% of the human genome is exonic, and it kind of varies between 0 and like 6%. So there's quite a bit of variation. So here, again, for autocomplete windows, FDN is the simple count of codons in the window, just how many codons there are. And FDX is the number of this conserved non-coding sites. So sequences that are non-genic, but that are alignable with zebrafish. Right, so the more non-coding sites, the greater FTX. Well, okay, so that's the definition. And you can see that there is a negative correlation again between theta nu and the number of codons and number of conserved non-coding sites. And these correlations are sort of independent of each other in a sense. I mean, so regions that have more genes also have more conserved non-coding sequences, but the partial correlations are are still significant. So this, again, is consistent with both recurrent selective sweeps and background selection, right? So these regions that have more genes are more likely to undergo selective sweeps and therefore more likely to have lower theta nu. I'm skipping a lot of statistical details here. You know, I don't know if we have time to talk about it. Just wanted to do it quickly. So the final one is exactly what we did in Drosophila, which is the number of non-synonymous differences with the chimp sequence, DN, or actually number of codons within which there is a non-synonymous difference between humans and chimps. And DX is number of differences between humans and chimps in the regions that are, again, alignable between human, chimp, and zebrafish. So that's our estimate of the number of the non-synonymous divergence, and this is kind of regulatory divergence. And you can see, again, there's a negative correlation between theta nu and DN, negative correlation with DX, and again, partial correlations are significant, right? So they appear to have independent effects. So this is all the data. Just to mention a few things. So background selection is a reduction of neutral polymorphism because of recurrent deleterious mutations, strongly deleterious mutations happening in the region that remove chromosomes from a population, effectively leaving fewer chromosomes that are free of neutral deleterious mutations and increasing amount of genetic drift. So the background selection should have a stronger effect in regions of low recombination, which is what we see here. It should have stronger effect in these regions, in regions that have more genes because they're under greater constraint, so there should be more deleterious mutations. So this effect could be explained or could be contributed to by background selection. The previous two correlations could be explained both by recurrence like sweeps and by background selection. This one gets a little trickier when you're trying to explain it by background selection. Right? So in this case, we see that the regions that have more non-synonymous differences have lower polymorphism. Now, this is the count of non-synonymous differences, so the more gene-rich regions have more non-synonymous differences. However, if you do a partial correlation of theta nu versus dn controlling for functional functional density, it's still negative. So this correlation is still negative even if you take out the effect of just gene density in there. If you do the opposite, if you do partial correlation on theta nu versus functional density controlling for the amount of divergence, the correlation becomes very weak and kind of gets close to non-significant. So it just depends on how you do all of the partials. So it looks like this correlation is robust to controlling for functional density. The other one is not. Now, background selection does not easily explain this correlation, right? Because in principle, you would say that regions that have greater amount of deleterious mutations on functional sites should have lower rate of neutral evolution, at least, right? If they have lower rate of neutral evolution, then DN, so the greater the background selection, so the greater the number of deleterious mutations, the stronger the background selection, the lower the level of polymorphism, and because neutral rate of neutral divergence and non-synonymous sites goes down as well, you have lower diversity and lower divergence. The correlation should be positive. That's one way to think about it. The problem is that when you have greater background selection, you stronger background selection, you reduce the proportion, you increase the number of strongly deleterious mutations. You reduce possible number of neutral ones, but the weakly deleterious ones have a greater possibly greater probability of fixation, possibly increasing divergence. So whether or not the distribution of selection coefficients is such that background selection would generate this negative correlation is not clear. Kind of not, maybe not natural to think that it should, but in principle it could. I think that it has not yet been kind of theoretically determined whether it's possible or not possible to have background selection generate this correlation. But if it does, then it has to have some particular properties. So the distribution of selection effects have to be sort of just so. Right? So there has to be enough strongly deleterious ones, and there has to be enough weakly deleterious ones, probabilities of fixations have to be increased in an appropriate way to generate the negative correlation. Whether it's like that in reality is not clear. But what we would like to argue is that these results show that there are signatures of at least some kind of form of hitchhiking, either background selection or recurrent selective sweeps. This seems to be sort of more natural to explain it by, at least partly by recurrent selective sweeps, and so that we can detect the signatures in humans. Now, Whether you expect to see them or not is not clear, because McDonald-Kreidman tests in humans have been more variable in terms of finding whether there is positive selection between humans and chimps or not, kind of varying between 0 and 30%. But possibly, it's likely that the rate of adaptation is lower in humans. Effective population size is supposed to be much smaller in humans, right? So what's weakly advantageous in Drosophila would be entirely neutral in humans. And it's sort of, I think it's somewhat surprising that these signatures are there. And sort of the strength of this, the strength of the effect, sort of the similar magnitude as in Drosophila, at least for theta. If you assume that all of these reduction of holomorphic is due to recurrent selective sweeps, then in humans, the level of neutral polymorphism is reduced by 6% compared to the nominal neutral value. And if you look only at the half of the genome that look only at the regions that are most gene rich, let's say where the functional density is greater than the mean functional density in the genome, then the reduction there is 13%. So it's in humans, at least according to this, it's a substantial effect, something that should probably not be ignored. All right. One last slide, and then we're done. So I guess both of the data sets might suggest that the dynamics of evolution, of population dynamics of neutral or slightly deleterious advantageous ones could be significantly impacted by strongly advantageous mutations in both of these organisms. And this is just kind of illustration of the path of a neutral mutant that's destined to be fixed in a case of genetic drift. So it just changes its frequency. This is the frequency, this is the number of generations, so it takes a long time, and because it's destined to be fixed, it goes up, it kind of has the binomial sampling generates the stochasticity. Below is the simulation that Guy ran of the recurrent selective sweeps using sort of parameters that, as it turned out later, the simulation I think was run before we knew the facts, but then it just turned out that the numbers just happened to be exactly...
Well, we knew some facts, to the extent they're facts.
Well, we didn't know that... there's some amount of fine-tuning possibly happened, but the rate similar to what we got from the Drosophila data, and this is, a neutral polymorphism that's destined to be fixed, and the... What mark here are moments where its frequency changed, I think, by more than 5%, right, or something like that. And there, in this particular case, there are five such events, and this number represents the distance at which the advantageous mutation happened. And so here, it's 1%, right, or 1/10%. The advantageous substitutions have selection coefficient of like 1%.
1% is the population size of 10^5.
Yeah. 10^5. So. Well, no, 10^-3, right? I think it's NES is the right one. NES of 10^4.
Yeah,
NES 10^4. So about 80 kb, 170 kb, and so forth. And you can see that its trajectory is also random. Sometimes the sweeps bring the frequency up, sometimes down, but it's much jerkier. And so there's a lot of stochasticity that's introduced by these selective sweeps happening elsewhere in the genome. What John Gillespie called genetic draft rather than genetic drift. And it's clear that if these parameters are real, then that stochasticity is an important component of stochasticity in populations. It should not be ignored. So I don't remember from our results, we sort of estimated that a neutral polymorphism that's destined to be fixed on average experiences like two selective sweeps, a substantial effect in its vicinity during its sojourn time. So it's something that a lot of polymorphism, at least in Drosophila, would feel, and sort of similar Similarly, in humans, at least in gene-rich regions, is going to be the case as well. Something to think about.
Did you? I missed where you estimated the selection coefficient in humans.
We did not estimate it. So we did not estimate it. So in humans, it just turned out to be much more difficult. So we first went just for the correlations to see whether there's a signal there. We did looked at Q, the same way as in Drosophila. It's also negative, but it's like what Guy was alluding to. It's such a difficult measure statistically because of the minima and because the gene density varies a lot and everything else varies a lot. It just turns out to be very hard to convince yourself that it's not a statistical artifact. And so far, we have not convinced ourselves.
The 6% estimate that you were giving for humans?
Yeah.
How does that work? I mean, in Drosophila, you looked only in regions of high recombination, but
that's right.
Humans, how did you take into account recombination?
So this is just this correlation, no effect. So we're just saying this what should, in regions of DN equals zero, that's the level of polymorphism. How much lower is it genome-wide because of the correlation with DN?
Across 400 kb. So this is really a number to interpret in the context of a 400 kb window. So it's saying there's a 6% reduction on average in 400 kb windows across the human genome.
Yeah, but why does it matter this 400 kb window?
So I don't know if this matters. I haven't thought this through, but it seems like there's extraordinarily strong recombination rate heterogeneity in humans. So
yeah.
The mean recombination is a substantial overestimate of the median recombination, and so it's not clear to me that these things average out in a way that.
But this, right, so I'm just saying our estimate is much dumber than that. The recombination rate is not involved at all.
But if I knew what the selection coefficients were, so I knew exactly what scale to measure them.
I see.
Wouldn't I?
Oh yeah, in that sense, yes. In that sense, yes.
Average things out less and yeah. Maybe see more of a reduction.
Yeah. But the kind of the reduction is still 6% genome wide. Right. If you wanted to estimate something about selection coefficient and the window in which there is reduced, then it would matter. But I mean, I'm just saying the procedure is just—it's very, very dumb.
So what Molly's saying, I think, is that if you had smaller windows, you may have got a bigger difference. And the reason is here, if the 400 kb scale is too large, then you're already doing one layer of averaging, so you're pushing everything more towards the
mean. That's true. Wow. I to be honest, I'm not sure it's true, but it's kind of, we can. Discuss it. Yeah.
So one interesting thing is that you know selection scales with population size, and so if you estimate S is 1% in Drosophila, that's NS of
10,000,
and that same mutation would have NS of 100 in
that's
humans,
right.
Which is on the order of what I estimated in Drosophila, and we call it weak selection in Drosophila.
That's right.
But in humans, we're calling it strong selection. So I'm just wondering, like...
Sorry, can I say it again?
Well, we're calling it strong selection in humans. Like, what are we calling strong selection in humans? What I'm saying is that the argument in Drosophila was that with the Q statistic, we're not detecting things that have two NS of 100.
That's right.
But somehow we're detecting them in humans unless S is much larger in humans.
Unless S is much larger in humans.
10%.
Yeah.
That would be the
No. I guess it would, I mean, hard to tell. I mean, I was surprised to see it. I mean, the Q correlates very weakly with so in Drosophila Q was the strongest correlate. In humans, it's just it's a barely negative correlation. And so part of the reason why we did not include it here is that depending on how you do it, it kind of flips in and out. So it's possible that in Drosophila, it's mostly affected by strong advantageous ones. In humans, you don't have them, right? Because 10% ones are rare. All you have are kind of your range, and then they generate very weak effect on Q. But who knows? There's just so much noise there. I don't know.
So I don't quite see why N would enter here so much. So obviously N needs to be large such that they stick out of the stochasticity of genetic drift.
Yeah.
But the time scale really is set by S. So Y of S is sort of the number of generations you needed to take over.
That's right.
And that you want to compare to the recombination rate. And so once you are in a regime where NS is big, you
That's
really
true.
Don't have to care too much about N anymore.
That's true. Because it's just a matter of S over C, right? It's true. The N does not enter. Good point.
Compared to that, it's not only relative to recombination, it's relative to the strength of genetic drift. I mean, that's the point of scaling.
Right, but that we sort of need anyway, that it is strong genetic drift.
But is 100 strong?
It's much bigger than one.
And I guess 100?
Yeah, I really think it is strong. I mean, any theoretician, I always think about, you know, this famous graph of convergence, you know, where you look at, you know, you have essentially NS. Where this is something like NS, and this is the you know, rate relative to neutrality. So this is one, that's the neutral rate, and if you have no selection at all, then things are there. And then he has this graph, you know, where you can look at the effect of polymorphism. So one is kind of polymorphism, and then the other is divergence, and it kind of goes through like this, that is to say, these are deleterious mutations.
That's pretty much all
around. But sort of this is NS of 10, and here's NS of 100, and by the time you get to 100, on either side, the fixation is immensely larger than it is due to the drift. The drift is as essentially, it hardly enters into the error of an estimation.
But Peter, what's your worry about strong there?
Just close to the boundary, that's all. I mean, if you want to call NS of 100 strong, it's fine.
Yeah.
I agree with you, yes. In terms of polymorphism to divergence, it's all over after 2 NS of 10. But,
yeah. In terms of the sojourn time, you worried
I'm
about?
I'm just saying, like, you know, changes in population size of tenfold or something are going to affect this dynamic. Whereas, usually when you think of strong selection, you know, it's not strong selection in terms of 1% selective advantage in Drosophila. That's my only point, that we're talking about different types of mutations.
You're just going to be farther from the boundary. Far enough from the boundary.
Yeah, like where these advantageous mutations are not going to be affected by tenfold changes of population size in Drosophila.
So like during the bottleneck, it's still advantageous.
That type of thing, yeah. So they're like unconditionally advantageous.
Yeah.
Strong advantage. Meanwhile, given the uncertainty in these estimates, I mean, I don't think that, you know, within tenfold of a boundary is a very safe place to be, given the uncertainty in the investments. So, I guess that's what I'm worried about.
So you don't feel very safe. Don't feel much safer.
There's one line of evidence in humans that suggests that there hasn't been a lot of strong selection, at least recently, which is that there are, at least acting on single loci, which is that there are essentially no fixed differences between human populations. So if you think that human populations left Africa 100,000 years ago and, you know, migrated around the world, and there was some adaptation to new environments, a lot of habituating to cold winters and Drosophila, then it's surprising, because with a selection coefficient of 100, you'd expect some fixed differences in the past to have occurred in the past 50,000 years or so. And when you look at 4 million SNPs in HapMap, you find 10 of them.
But lactase, for example.
Only if they have been sufficiently isolated after that, right?
But some of these populations, I mean, I think it's not a bad assumption for some of these populations that, I mean, it's not that they're found at 90% but not fixed. There's just very, very few huge differences in allele frequencies between human populations. I mean, handful few.
I mean, would you include lactase as one of them, or?
Well, lactase is, you know, to date, the strongest example of selection we have in the human genome, and, you know, if you believe the selection coefficient estimates, it's a couple percent.
Yeah, but it's not, I'm just saying it's not fixed.
Well, it is fixed in, it is, well, first of all, it's post-agricultural, so it's much more recent than that. It's only 10,000 years. But second of all, it's close to fixed in Northern European populations. It's at 90%.
So when you're saying there are very few SNPs that are as divergent as lactase.
Is there modeling of that? So what you would expect if with a certain strength and a certain sort of what we know about migration?
Yeah,
so
Jonathan Pritchard has a paper which is, I don't think it's submitted somewhere, that tries to get a set, sort of a very rough upper bound of how much there could be.
Yeah.
So your technique was trying to detect recurrent selection, right? That's what you were saying.
Yeah.
But maybe there's certainly some adaptations between humans and chimps that happen just once, maybe.
That's right.
Recurrently. Do we have any chance of detecting?
Well, I guess to the extent that it contributes to divergence, then it will contribute some.
It was recent, then.
I mean, if it was recent, then we might be able to see it, but I mean, we have a much better chance of seeing recurring things. If it happened a long time ago, then it's just going to be noise. If it happened recently, it's just going to be, you know, say one amino acid difference that generated a recent selective sweep. Then, you know, depends on what else. If the neutrophil rate there is very high, then it's just going to be a marginally insignificant increase in DN, and we will miss it.
But your method would notice this, right?
No, I think all of this is kind of steady state, right? And we go to steady state because of the problem with demography, because it's just very hard to figure out what to expect in the demography, and so looking at DN, something like that, gets you out of the problem with demography, because DN should not be affected by demography, but then it gets you into the other side of the problem, that you only see the, you know, recurrent part of the process. And, you know, in Drosophila, people know something about demography, but I guess, you know, Peter is one of the experts on that, but I guess you would agree that it's still very much unclear what really happened.
Yeah, I mean, we just know a little bit about very recent demography.
Very recent demography, but even that's probably, I mean, the models that have been fit to the data are just very simple models, just a simple bottleneck, and doesn't explain all of the data that well, and just so forth. It just... Right, and it could have very severe effects on levels of polymorphism. So, it's actually, I'm not sure whether that's ever going to be dealt with satisfactorily.
It's based on possibilities. What demography and migration so can do. I mean, it's...
Well, we're kind of screwed. Life.
Oh, very nice.